CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first interview, folks, is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Lainey Etkind will be telling us about dysautonomia. So, can you tell me a little bit about the foundation?
Sure. The foundation was established more than 70 years ago by parents of children who had FD, and they just didn't know how to manage it, and so they bonded together and established the foundation to raise funds and awareness and to build a community. So, and it's been going strong ever since.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, how does FD typically affect a person?
So, FD is much easier to say than familial dysautonomia, so that's what we usually call it. But it is a neurological disorder, and it impacts the autonomic nervous system and the sensory nervous system. And basically what that means, and I'm not a doctor, I run the foundation, so... but what it means is that all the things that our bodies do automatically that are controlled by our autonomic systems, like breathing, controlling our blood pressure, controlling our body temperature, digestion, swallowing, producing tears, feeling pain, sensing heat and cold, all of those kinds of things that most people's bodies do automatically without us thinking about it. People who have autonomic disorders such as FD, their bodies don't do these things automatically. So either they have to be very aware of things, like know if they're touching something hot because they're not going to feel it, or they have to find other ways of regulating those things.
So how does the foundation go about reaching out to the affected communities?
Well, so I had mentioned that the organization, the foundation, was established 70 years ago. About 50 years ago, we established a medical center of excellence where we have a physician who specializes in the care of FD, and we established that center at NYU Langone in New York. And because we have that center and that medical care is focused there, people usually find us because they're looking for answers. I mean, a lot of times with rare diseases in general, it takes time for people who are suffering from the rare disease to get a diagnosis. You'll find that to be a very common journey for families. But now that we've identified the gene that causes FD, it's a lot easier to diagnose. But, you know, it's still sometimes it takes time. But once people know they have FD, they know that they can get the best medical care, whether in person or, of course, these days by telemedicine. And also our doctors at NYU consult with other people's personal physicians, you know, all over the country and all over the world. But it's become pretty easy for us to form a community because people are looking for the specialized medical care that you need if you have FD, and they're getting it through the center at NYU, which is supported by the foundation. I mean, that's basically what we're raising funds for, is to support that medical care. What's also happening at the NYU Dysautonomia Center is we have created a natural history study, which is basically collecting data from patients. And fortunately, the doctor who established the center 50 years ago had enough foresight to start collecting data way back then. So we have a very robust natural history study. And what that means is, you know, in a typical clinical trial, you will have a control group and you'll have, you know, the group that is getting the treatment. But when you have an ultra rare disease like FD, we have fewer than 350 people living with the disorder worldwide right now, and only about 150 people in the United States. It's very hard to have a control group. You just don't have that many extra people. So the natural history study sort of serves as the control, because you know what the natural progression of the disease is in people who have had it. So we're maintaining that natural history study and feeding data into it on a regular basis. Many people come to the center at NYU for an annual checkup. And actually, since the pandemic, we've developed a telemedicine kit, which we send out to families all over the country. And we've actually just developed a telemedicine kit for our families in the UK. So we can even do the annual physicals and annual checkups remotely now.
So I'm curious, the small number of patients, do you think there's a chance that there are some out there who have conditions similar to FD that just haven't been identified yet?
We do think so. FD right now is almost exclusively found in people who have Eastern European Jewish ancestry. But what we think is that, you know, over the years, like during the Holocaust, for example, when people sort of went underground and disappeared into the general population because they were trying to save their lives, for other reasons, going back hundreds of years, there has been, the diaspora of the Jewish population. So we do think that there are people out there that have FD that we don't know about. I mean, even here in the United States, and even here with the ability to do a genetic diagnosis, to identify the gene, there are people that it takes years to identify FD. So we do believe that that there are people out there in the Jewish community, and we think that my president has a really cute saying. She says, "Jewish genes don't go to synagogue." So we think there are a lot of people out there that don't even know that they may have Jewish ancestry, who may be carriers of the disease. And so, yes, we have actually in the past applied for a grant to look for other people in other populations, especially maybe in Eastern Europe, in South America, where there's a diaspora of Jewish people or people of Jewish heritage. So, and there may be other populations that are harboring this gene as well. So the long answer to your short question is yes.
So in your time with the foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Well, I've been executive director for 5 years, so it's almost 5 years. It's a pretty short amount of time in the long history of the foundation. But we are at a very exciting precipice right now. There is no approved treatment for FD. The center has had tremendous success in extending the lives of people who are living with FD. It used to be that when babies were born with FD and once they were diagnosed, their parents were told that their child would probably not live to age 5. Many of those kids are now in their 30s. And basically that has come as a result of the excellent care that was developed at Dysautonomia Center, and mainly by giving them feeding tubes, because a lot of the babies were not being able to eat enough to sustain them, or they were aspirating and they were developing pneumonia and they were dying. So many people with FD into their adulthood get most of their nutrition and liquids by a feeding tube, and that has really saved and prolonged their lives. So while we are, you know, providing excellent care, there is no medical, there's no drug or treatment that is life prolonging or life extending. However, we have, so just the fact that right now the prognosis for someone with FD, 75% of people with FD are living to age 40. So that's really exciting. But we also have a scientific advisory board that is researchers from all over the world, and many of whom are very prominent in their fields. And we currently have three very promising treatments that are getting closer and closer to being ready to be tested in the clinic. So I would say that that's probably the most exciting advancement that's happening in our community right now. We have our scientists are going to be gathering again together in November to share what they're learning, and to hopefully, gather knowledge and energy from one another. And we are really excited to see this moving forward.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Steve Gregg about NAFC. So, can you tell me a little bit about NAFC?
Yeah, we're the National Association for Continence. We were founded in 1983 by a woman who was well ahead of her time. Our focus is primarily bladder and bowel dysfunction, and we are probably the most prolific nonprofit advocacy organization in this space.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the affected communities?
You know, I think it happens a variety of ways, but, 2022, it's almost all digital now. So, we have a variety of tools that work in an integrated fashion. First and foremost is NAFC.org, which is a repository for all new information. And I'll tell you a little bit about what people are looking for in just a moment. Underneath that, if you will, we have a pretty significant 5,7500 forum members, because when people come in and want to learn about bladder and bowel dysfunction, they oftentimes say, I want to talk to somebody like me. And then we have social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. It's all branded Be Health, because nobody actually wants to have in their RSS feed the word incontinence. So it also gives us a chance to talk about better lifestyle, how do you manage your health, those kinds of things. And Be Health effectively stands for better bladder and bowel health. When people come to NAFC, they basically have four questions. What is this? And so we can talk about conditions. Two, why is it happening to me? That's one we typically can't answer. Three, who do I talk to who can help me? And four, how do I have a meaningful conversation with that healthcare provider or pelvic floor specialist? So we tend to focus all of our stuff that way. To answer those questions, social media is used primarily first and foremost to drive viewers into NAFC for new content.
So, I'm curious, do you ever encounter any myths or misperceptions concerning incontinence or bladder dysfunction?
Well, there's a lot of myths in terms of how to cure it, but is there something specifically you're asking?
Just in general, is there ever anyone who says, oh, I've heard this, or my friend told me that about it?
It's not too much of that. It's actually the opposite. What happens is oftentimes the first point of entry for care, health care provider care, is primary care doctors. And in the United States, primary care doctors are basically not trained or taught anything about incontinence. And they're so limited in terms of time. Forrester presented some research back in 2010, so it was pretty old, that a primary care doctor in the United States needs to see a patient about every 8 minutes to make a living. And so by the time I talk to you about your heart rate, your blood pressure, triglycerides, your weight, I'm out of time. So often what happens is more women than men, when they go in and talk to their doctor, they're told one of two things. I have not heard it in 22. I heard it in 20. The doctor actually said to a patient, you really shouldn't have had those babies. Or it's a sign of getting older and there's nothing you can do about it. And so there is that myth that reinforces sort of the stigma that there's nothing you can do about it. And that's actually just not true.
So when you provide support, how do you get around those misperceptions and let people know the steps they can take?
So we are an unbiased, non-biased organization. We provide scientific information. We do not provide clinical medicine, nor do we provide clinical recommendations. But we talk about what the condition is. You know, so if you have these kinds of symptoms, it's probably like that. And then we spend a lot of time talking about educating patients on treatment options. The reason for that is so that when they go in to have their doctor, they can have a meaningful conversation about all of the treatment options. So by size, incontinence is fairly big. There are 37 million Americans that have symptoms for overactive bladder or urge-related incontinence. When I got to go, I got to go right now. About 35 million adults that are symptomatic for stress urinary incontinence. So laugh, sneeze, lift a child, package, anything that increases abdominal pressure causes some leaking. So now we're at 70 million. Mixed incontinence, because folks have both. You had fecal incontinence, bowel-related issues. You know, you could probably get to 90 million, if not 100 million Americans, adult Americans. So it's pretty big.
So in your time with NAFC, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
You know, success, you know, my background was a little different. I came from an advertising background and most recently in healthcare marketing. And so we worked with clients to do what you would expect your agency to do, help on all business aspects. Success here is... I get a letter about once a month. It may or may not have a check in it. The check could be anywhere from $2 to $5. And I have one on my desk today that says, thank you for what you do, a little post-it note. So we're actually reaching people, and we're helping them find the care they want. But by size, when I joined, from a digital standpoint, we were seeing about 30,000 unique visitors a month. And about 90% of them were staying less than a minute, partly because... we were very science-oriented, we weren't very compassionate, we weren't very welcoming, we weren't very encouraging, and we changed that. And so right now we're receiving about 150,000 unique visitors a month, which is pretty good. Now, given those big numbers I told you, we're the tallest gnome on the lawn, right? So we're helping, you know, 2 million adults every year, but if it's really 80 to 100 million, we've got a long way to go. And a large part of that is in the United States and in Canada, people don't know where to go for information.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Lainey Etkind told us a little bit about dysautonomia,
And Steve Gregg told us a little bit about NAFC. In this segment of our show, Dean Sir will be telling us a little bit about the MLD Foundation. So, can you tell me a little bit about the MLD Foundation?
Yes. I'm Dean Sir, president and co-founder of MLD Foundation. Two of my three were diagnosed with MLD back in the mid-90s, and that led us to putting the foundation together to provide support for families, and ultimately we got involved in research and policy and clinical trials and all kinds of things.
So, for those who might not be as familiar, how does MLD typically affect a person?
MLD is a rare terminal neurometabolic condition, and there are generally three forms of the disease: late infantile, 12 to 24 month onset; juvenile, which is 4 years to the forms of the disease. It shows up as motor skill problems. The child will progress normally and then either stop developing motor skills or might start regressing. In the older juveniles and the adults, it could show up as cognitive and behavioral issues first.
So, in that sense, is there any risk that because it manifests the symptoms of other conditions, that it might be misdiagnosed?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, most families that have some symptoms have gone through a diagnostic odyssey with one or more misdiagnoses. We work with those families all of the time. And that's very unfortunate because the limited therapies today and the emerging therapies, gene therapy is coming along. They require that the patients, children and infants be pre-symptomatic. So yes, it's always, I should say always, but very often misdiagnosed. An MRI is a primary diagnostic tool. If you bump your head or there's some cause for concern, MRIs are pretty easy to get, and most radiologists see white matter disorders, and they look in, I don't know, they look on Google and they say, hey, MLD is one of the more common ones. You probably have MLD, but if you don't have an MRI or anything like that to get started, it can be diagnosed as MS, it can be diagnosed as behavioral issues, misdiagnosed, I should say. So, newborn screening is critical to newborn screening is critical for us to diagnose the children and the adults for that matter, but diagnose them all when they're young, when they're pre-symptomatic.
So when you say it's a rare condition, do you know offhand about how many people are affected?
Yes, the estimates range from 1 in 40,000 births to a little over 1 in 100,000 births. We've done some analysis, and that would show several thousand patients living in the United States and the EU, kind of the first primary markets for most biopharmas. It's about 10 times that many worldwide. This disease is cross-borders, doesn't care what language you speak or where you're from. It's pretty universal.
So, how does the foundation go about reaching out to the affected population, let them know there is some support?
Well, you know, that's changed a lot over the past two decades as we've been serving. Initially, we had an email list and a website, and people came to us. And so it was pretty easy to be that focal point, and we were the sole a global focal point for MLD for quite some period of time. But now, as you know, we all have what I call Dr. Google and Nurse Facebook, where you can join social media and get connected through social media without coming through the advocacy group. And that's both a positive and a negative. It's positive because families are getting connected to families, and I think that's really, really important. But it can be a negative because, as we just talked, families can be misdiagnosed, and they can assume their diagnosis without doing some double checking. They also can get misinformation because this disease varies quite a bit across patients, and one family's experience may not be appropriate for the next family in terms of what you would do for clinical care or even what you might consider for therapies.
So, in your time with the foundation, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And again, with two decades of work here, we've seen a lot of things change over time. First off, with transplant, traditional stem cell bone marrow transplant, we have had the blessing of seeing a very small handful of patients that basically transplant was all but curative for them. I mean, nominal. If you just ran across one of those patients, you probably wouldn't think anything was wrong with them. We would see, because we know the subtleties of the symptoms. But what's really been dramatic is seeing the gene therapy come along. Gene therapy for MLD was developed in Italy, starting back actually in the early 90s, so quite some time ago, went into clinical trials about 15 years ago, was approved by the EU, because it was developed and tested in the EU, it was approved by them in late 2020, and it's working its way through the United States FDA at this point, and we hope for approval in, you know, takes a while to get these things reviewed, but over the next year or two. The results from gene therapy have been just transformative for pre-symptomatic patients. The therapy is effective. The kids are running and jumping and playing and at their grade levels in school and so on. And I say kids because so far it's only been available to late infantile and early juvenile forms.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward with the trials and finding better treatments, what would you say?
Well, and this is what we do say. We are blessed with MLD that we have some seven, perhaps eight, biopharmas working on MLD. About half of those are public and announced, the other half are not. So really the work with MLD is from a patient perspective, not to spend too much time saying we need more trials, we need more therapies. It's to be available when we need some natural history study data because we're putting together a clinical trial design or a packet for the FDA to do a review. It's being available when asked to support some of the policy changes that are necessary. I mentioned gene therapy is an emerging very, very good therapy for MLD, but it's also very expensive. It's a multi-million dollar therapy. And both our public and our private payers, the Medicaid system, Medicare, as well as private insurance here in the U.S., and then governmental payers for, you know, single payers in other countries, they're challenged with multi-million dollar payments and how to make them, some of the things that we're looking at, for example, are guarantees that the biopharma is putting on those payments so that they will be refunded money if the therapy doesn't work like they promise. You know, that's not ideal for the patient, but it's certainly from a financial perspective, it's, you know, it's like a guarantee on anything that you would buy. So we're looking at creative ways to do that. And those are policy issues, foundational changes, and we need help with that. Same thing with appropriations and support to get newborn screening. And, of course, all the different U.S. states, there's 50 of those, actually 54 programs in the U.S., but internationally as well. Newborn screening in many countries is not as advanced as it is here, and we need to serve those patients as well. And those are all public policy issues that we need support with.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Really resonated with me, folks, when Steve said that people call up asking for information. They want to talk to someone like themselves. Fact is, in disability life, one of the most difficult things is the perception, I'm facing this all alone. I'm the only one who understands my situation. The instant you meet someone, similar experience, similar story, if you will, get this connection that can change your entire outlook. I've heard time and again people hearing those exact words, you're not the only one, coming to a place where they realize there's a lot more hope in the world than they might once have thought. And that is the beginning of how we build progress, the realization that in community we can do better. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me, you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.